Professional wrestling is the one true sport. Other sports have their share of intense, dramatic moments, but nothing can compare with professional wrestling. Welcome to Wrestling History X, where three friends come together to talk about the stories behind the matches. I'm Matt.
I'm a hip dinosaur.
And I am Shane, the Pain Maker.
Welcome to episode 258, WCW Monday Night Nitro.
It's got to be a big one, a good one, something significant.
Something's going on.
We're watching a Nitro.
So this was the 91st episode of Nitro, produced by WCW. It would take place on June 9th, 1997, from the Fleet Center in Boston, Massachusetts.
Fleet Week.
With an attendance of 18,003.
It's a decent-sized number.
It's a huge number.
We haven't had one of those WC numbers in a while. No. Especially for a Nitro.
Yeah, maybe they haven't been to Massachusetts in a while.
But, I mean, I guess...
Maybe it's the first time they've been back to Massachusetts since NWO.
It's very possible.
Yeah. Could be.
The TV rating was a 3.4. And by comparison, just so we know where we're at, Raw at this week was a 2.2. So you can tell that WCW's still solidly in the lead.
I wonder what week this is in the 83 weeks.
I don't have that...
I'm not asking you to look it up. I'm just... Being nine. A pain in the ass.
Nine.
Okay. That sounds good.
Well, we are in Boston, Massachusetts. So, Shane, did you do what you do?
Well, looking at the glasses in front of me, I think I might have. I've never heard of this before, but I was doing what I do. And, you know, jumped on the old Google machine and said, what the hell do people eat, drink, do in Boston or Massachusetts in general? And looked at the sandwich that they had, and we've already had the sandwich, and it was amazing, that fluffernutter with the bananas and crunchy peanut butter and grilled and ooey-gooey deliciousness. Absolutely. And as much as I'd love to go into a diabetic coma from that, I decided we've already had it, we got to try something different. So I looked at the drinks, and you know, the technical official drink for Massachusetts is the Cape Codder, and I believe we've already done a Cape Codder. If not, we've... all had something close to a Cape Cod or
like
Cape Codder.
Cranberry vodka, right?
Yeah, with lime.
Yeah.
Drink of choice for me, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Not that there's, it's delicious, but then I saw that there's an unofficial drink for Massachusetts, and it's this one, and I thought it kind of plays into it all. I mean, not only is it Boston and Massachusetts, but, you know, wrestlers typically have to take one of these or some of these, and sometimes they like to take lots of these. This, my friends, is the painkiller. It is kind of a play.
It's not called the Soma?
No. It's not called the Soma, but you you might drink so much of it that
yeah.
You know, it'll give you the same effect.
Yeah, it pairs well with a Soma, makes it twice as strong.
There you go. It's kind of a play on a pina colada. It's dark rum, pineapple juice, a little bit of fresh squeezed orange juice, some cream of coconut, and then shaken in a cocktail tin over ice, poured over crushed ice, garnished with a little chunk of pineapple and a maraschino cherry or whatever. You know, you could put an orange wedge on there if you wanted to. Whatever. It's pretty damn tasty. I mean, Matt's is already gone.
It's delicious.
Yours is almost gone. Yeah. I'm a slow sipper anyways, plus I have my coffee over here that I go back and forth with.
Crazy person. Coffee and pineapple. It is bizarre to think, because I'm like, oh, in Massachusetts, don't they just drink, like, beer and whiskey?
Beer and whiskey and, you know, cranberry juice.
Yeah, but to think of, like, this cocktail does not seem like a Massachusetts cocktail.
There's one thing that's missing from it, and maybe that would be the Massachusetts twist, because, you know, it's kind of New Englandish, and, you know, that's...
You have to stir with your coffee.
Where, like, Thanksgiving was... created was in the New England area where they, you know, the pilgrims settled and whatnot. It's supposed to have some fresh or some grated fresh nutmeg on top of it. So maybe that would just like completely seal the deal there. I could always check your spice cabinet, see if you've got some dried nutmeg.
I do have dried nutmeg.
Because it's not powder. Necessarily supposed to be on there for the flavor. It's more for the aromatics of it, said. Yeah. But I didn't go by an actual grocery store to see if they had any fresh nutmeg.
Have you ever bought fresh nutmeg?
I have not.
It's pretty great to use instead, but I don't know if it's expensive or what, but yeah, you just kind of...
It's not worth it.
You don't think so?
I figure for three drinks...
I mean, it's not worth it for this.
There's no point in buying it, so...
But, you know, if you're making a pumpkin pie or something.
But it says this is a popular drink in both warm and cold weather. It's a rather warm day today in Oklahoma, so it felt like a perfect drink for a nice, bright, sunny, windy, 80-something degree day.
Yeah, no, it's delicious.
As we talk about some wrestling. I can't help but think, though, a splash of cranberry would probably be really good in this.
A splash of cranberry always makes everything better.
Yep.
But something that would happen right around the same time as this Nitro, a trio of albums would come out.
Mm-hmm.
We have En Vogue's EV3.
Okay, I was going to say Control the Narrative, but no, that's EC3. What the hell's EC3? There we go.
Casey and JoJo's Love Always.
Mm-hmm.
And a personal favorite of mine. It's the only reason it's included.
Yeah. I got a question or two about it.
Switchfoot's Legend of Chin.
What does Chin mean?
He was a friend of theirs.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Oh, so I was like, Chin. What is that?
The new Zelda.
But is this the En Vogue record, or is this like the sophomore? What's the single?
What's It Gonna Be was on this one. Is that what it's called, or is it Don't Let Go?
Don't Let Go.
There we go.
Whatever and Too Gone Too Long were the three singles.
Yeah.
I don't know if I know any of those.
You've most likely heard Don't Let Go, because that one, it played on everything in the 90s.
Yeah. And then is this the Casey and JoJo album with...
All My Life.
Oh, yeah. Papers of Words Like You.
I already pictured in the video. Like the silk sheets blowing in the background.
The old En Vogue. Oh, is this the one with the in the desert with the sheets flying and everything?
I think so. What's it gonna be?
Yep, I know this song. This is a good song.
Yeah. Like, there's no way you've been alive this long and never heard it.
Also crazy, too, because, like, for R&B song, those, like, live, like, rock drums sound so good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I never quite noticed that until right now.
I want to say they played OKC Pride, like, a decade ago.
Oh, really?
Because I was working, running concessions at one of the beer trucks. I want to say that's who it was.
And then, yeah, Kate, what was the group Casey and JoJo was in before they, like...
Jodeci.
Yeah.
Yeah, they broke apart. But yeah, this is the album that had All My Life.
Huge song.
Yeah. You know, if you don't know the song, I wish the intro wasn't, like, 7 minutes long here, but, you know.
I think this is the only Casey and JoJo song anybody knows, but everybody knows the hell out of it. I mean, I'm sure there's some fans. Jodeci was pretty big.
I will never fuck. Is that them?
Oh, yeah, another Lover Like You. Or Sweeter Than You. Yeah. Is that them?
They were on the Tupac song, How Do You Want It. That's probably their second most popular song, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's like Jodeci was pretty big, but Casey and JoJo crossed over to, like, you know, a wide audience, essentially.
Yeah, that piano. Like, yeah. As soon as that piano hits, you go...
You get them chills.
I mean, we all know what this song is. Like I said, from the piano.
And then Switchfoot, did they pop off? Or are they on, like, tooth and nail at this point?
I don't even know if they were on. I mean, this is literally their first album. They were just being played on Christian radio at this point. I mean, actually, their sound at this point is complete surf rock. It's not...
Really? It's not, like, drop D guitar rock?
I mean, this was the song that hit. It's called Kim 6A. But yeah, it's like... It was very... It
sounds like some Orange County shit.
Yeah. I mean, they're from San Diego. It's a three-piece guitar, drum, bass. They're just... You know. It's very simple, but like,
it's like a it's basically ska without horns. Kind of has a bit of a Everclear.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not horrific.
No, it's definitely not horrific. Yeah, Switchfoot doesn't really hit big until, what was the movie? With Mandy Moore, Devin Sawa. Walk to Remember.
Okay.
A couple of their songs, like their songs are like the major songs that are on that soundtrack.
Okay.
Mandy Moore actually even sings the song that she sings, Only Hope, in the movie is a Switchfoot song. But like Dare You to Move and Meant to Live were both on that soundtrack. And those songs were actually on their second album. But because they become so popular,
they re-recorded them for the third album.
Yeah. And the third album came out through Sony.
It's also one of those things too where it's like, okay, well, these songs, we nailed it. So we're just going to move them over to the new album and write more songs in this vein. It happens a lot. You see that a lot in...
especially when you're moving... company,
yeah, labels
from a smaller label to a bigger label.
Yeah,
you definitely are going to sometimes re-record those.
But I mean, and those are the two biggest singles, right?
Yeah, those are the two songs that like
also hit
most people. When you think Switchfoot, you think Dare You to Move and Meant to Love.
Yeah, I was like trying to think of a Switchfoot song, and I was like, oh, and then you said those titles, I was like, oh, I know what both those songs are.
So I don't really know much Switchfoot.
Matt does.
I didn't really listen to much of them. The other two, I did for sure.
Yeah, I didn't torture Shane with music all the time.
When we used to work together. Yeah.
That was back when we could wear, you know, headphones and earbuds and whatnot. He'd keep his music to himself, which I wish we could still have those, because there's so many musics that I hear at work these days that I'm like, why do you think anybody else wants to hear this?
I know, it's so crazy. It's like, it's like, nobody's interested in your taste. Also, if you're going to play stuff on a big speaker, you got to kind of read the room, I think, and play. It's like if you go to a party or whatever and you're the one with the Bluetooth speaker, you don't just play the things that you like. Mm-hmm. You got to
put on a party mix.
You got to DJ a little bit.
Yeah.
Appeal to the people. Now, Casey and JoJo, that album, I mean, All My Life was good, and then it set it up for, what the hell did they have? Other songs, Crazy. Tell Me It's Real, I think is what it was.
It's Crazy About My Baby, is that what it is?
Crazy, 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 Thinking About You Lately.
Lately, that's what it is. I was thinking about my baby. But I do know that one too. Yeah. But, I mean, that one song bought them both a couple of homes.
Oh, hell yeah. And Tell Me It's Real, every time I hear that one, it, I don't know, there was something about 90s R&B where you just have to crank it up and just like sing out all of your feelings in the car as you're driving down the road.
Yeah.
I mean, this is kind of like the... like the peak of it, and then it like continues for a while with Usher and stuff, but it kind of dies with Usher too.
Yeah,
as far as like broad R&B for everybody.
Yeah, it's like they took Boyz II Men and just like amped it up, just the emotion and everything. You know, they had almost that. I don't want to use Fantasia Barrino as an example, but
I have no idea
just that. You can feel their passion in their
voice. Yeah. Yeah.
If you're not getting goosebumps, then what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah, the in Vogue, this EV3, it looks like it was kind of their last hurrah.
That's what I was thinking, but I couldn't remember for sure.
Because it looks like they only released three other albums, and one of them was a Christmas one, so...
I mean, 97 is kind of like almost the end of the 90s as far as like... 90s music goes,
because they'd already had
then you get the rise of rap being more popular. We're not too far away from things like Limp Bizkit and whatnot like coming to a forefront, and Korn like getting on MTV in a big way, as opposed to being kind of a more of a weird underground thing.
This is around
Eminem was about to pop.
Spice Girls were hitting Spice big.
That's a good point. We're hitting the white boy band.
Yeah, TLC was already on the landscape, so they had kind of taken their place at the top of the R&B girl groups.
Yeah, but we're also pretty close to Destiny's Child.
True.
That first album, so many singles.
Very true.
Yeah, we're getting to TRL basically deciding what's cool and popular. Like, not, I don't know if cool is the right word, but popular as far as like radio and music sales goes.
I'll allow it.
And we all know that TRL is top-notch journalism.
Hey. I was mistaken for Carson Daly more than a couple times in my youth, so I'm okay with TRL.
Yeah, I mean, that's not, yeah, not terrible. I mean, he used that job to date some girls outside of his... Yeah, outside of his... he's not an ugly man by any means, but, you know, he did well off of that.
Some of the choices... I mean, he was like John Mayer before John Mayer.
Oh, yeah.
With
a lot less talent.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk some Nitro.
Yeah.
We get the opening with fire and the logo, and Tony Schiavone welcomes us to the show, joined by Mike Tenay and Larry Zbysko. And they talk about a video that we just saw, but it wasn't included on Peacock. So, it was Hollywood, Hogan, and Dennis Rodman making jokes. Who cares really what they said? They let us know that those two gentlemen will be teaming up at Bash at the Beach, but they don't know who their opponents will be. Tony then tells us about some of the matches on the show tonight. And then we are shown a limo arriving in the back. And it's Miss Elizabeth and Macho Man Randy Savage. They begin to emerge from the car when DDP arrives. So Macho closes the door, and he's inside. Miss Elizabeth is now, like, standing to the side. And Paige kicks out the window to the limo to get the door back open.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Paige unlocks the door and tries to get inside when Liz would slam the door into Paige's shoulder, allowing Savage and the limo to take off, leaving DDP laid out. And Liz just standing there.
Yeah, for some reason I thought she got in the car, but maybe not.
No, it sped off before she had any chance of getting in that car.
It also totally makes sense with the Macho Man Elizabeth dynamic.
But we go to our first match. Juventud Guerrera, Super Calo, and Ultimo Dragon versus La Parca, Psychosis, and Silver King. And this is Silver King's debut in WCW. And he is a AAA Hall of Famer. And later in his career, he would become the third Black Tiger and was also the villain in the Jack Black film Nacho Libre.
Never seen it.
It's all right.
Yeah, I believe you.
If you like Jack Black, you probably like it. If you don't, then...
That's probably why I haven't seen it.
There you go.
It's not my favorite.
See, I've never watched it either. I've seen, you know, enough of the memes and GIFs or GIFs or whatever the hell you call them inspired by it, but Jack Black just, like, standing, doing, like, the splits or something like that.
Yeah.
A stretch.
He has, like, a cape, I think. I don't know. A little bit of Jack Black goes a long way for me personally.
We also haven't seen Hoovy and La Parca since Nitro from February 24th, episode 244. Calo since Super Brawl 7, episode 243. And Psychosis since Uncensored 97, episode 246. So it's been a couple months or so since we've seen it. Mm-hmm. And Calo and Psychosis look to start, but Psychosis wants Ultimo, shoving him and daring him to enter, which brings in all six men. Now everyone settles down with Dragon and Psychosis left in the ring, with Ultimo being taken down by a clothesline, followed by being sent to a corner, where Dragon attempts his balance beam head scissors, but he ends up slipping on the ropes. And Psychosis goes for a splash in the corner, only for Ultimo to move, sending Psychosis crashing out to the floor. Now Super Calo and La Parca enter the ring to square off, where Calo back body drops Parca, only for Calo to charge in and be back body dropped himself out to the apron.
I love Super... Love is a strong word. Super Calo's, like, ring wear looks like a last minute, like, Halloween costume.
Always.
It's just like, I mean, I don't know. This is what I have.
But Calo fights off La Parca to springboard back in with head scissors. Another back body drop and a catapult that sends Parca out to the floor.
I mean, these guys are just eating it. Everybody's eating it in this match. between there's a, it's a little sloppy, but people were just fucking flying everywhere.
Yep.
Big old bumps.
Super Callow continues with a drop kick through the ropes, followed by a slingshot splash atop La Parca, which brings Hoovy and King into the ring, where Silver King sidesteps a cannonball by Guerrera. King hits a thrust kick, but then misses a splash in a corner as well, allowing Hoovy to leap off the top rope with a hurricanrana. And they begin running the ropes when Silver King would press Guerrera high into the air, only for Hoovy to counter it into a drop kick, sending King to the floor. So Psicosis and Ultimo rejoin the fray. And Dragon drops Psicosis with a kick combo, holds him down for Guerrera to springboard in with an elbow drop for a two count, followed by Hoovy nailing a spinning heel kick to La Parca and tagging out to Callow. And Parca hits a arm drag and a belly-to-belly suplex, followed by Psicosis slingshotting in for a leg drop to get a near fall. Silver King and La Parca then team up for a double clothesline on Super Callow, but he ducks before avoiding a kapoo kick from Parca, while Hoovy springboards in with a drop kick to King, only for Silver King to retaliate with a clothesline. Callow then sets up a pile driver of La Parca, but Psicosis makes the save with a top rope double axe handle. He then whips Guerrera to the ropes and back body drops him into the waiting arms of King, who attempts a powerbomb, only for Hoovy to counter it into a hurricanrana, sending Silver King out to the floor. Now La Parca with a spin kick to Super Callow, sending him to the floor, followed by Ultimo kicking La Parca out to the floor. And Psicosis attacks Dragon. He then goes to run the ropes with Ultimo following after with a handspring back elbow, only to be caught, which leads to the two fighting over a waistlock, until Psicosis rolls up Dragon for a two count. Ultimo then responds with a hurricanrana, but Psicosis rolls through to get a near fall, followed by a thrust kick and charging in, only for Dragon to monkey flip Psicosis out of the ring. Parca leaps in with a head scissors that takes Ultimo out of the ring, before Silver King uses a helping hand from La Parca to deliver a moonsault, only for Dragon to move in time, causing Psicosis to take the blow. Callow then flies over the ropes with a tope con hio onto King, followed by Parca doing a triple jump plancha onto Super Callow. Guerrera then baseball slides the chair into La Parca's face, followed by a double springboard plancha onto Parca.
I love seeing a chair like this. It's like one of those old school wooden
chairs.
Yeah, it looks like a one from 89.
Ultimo and Psicosis make their way back into the ring, where Dragon sets him up on a turnbuckle to deliver a Super Rana, and locking on the Dragon Sleeper for the submission
and the win.
Post-match, La Parca isn't finished, so he attacks Callow with the chair, whacking him and drop-kicking him into a corner.
That was kind of wild that one of the two guys in of the two guys anybody cares about at this point on this show, and it's like a week before a pay-per-view, and it's like, all right, well, we pin Psicosis, but it's like, well, it makes me assume we'll get an Ultimo Psicosis match at the pay-per-view.
We just might.
Yep.
Mean Gene's then on the stage, bringing out Lex Luger. And Oakland talks about the Hogan-Rodman match and asks if Luger had heard about it, with Lex saying he and Giant have signed a contract for that match at Bash at the Beach. You guys excited about that one?
Totally.
I mean, Lex is always up and down, but Lex looks great here. He looks happy, and the crowd loves him, and I love to see it.
Luger also mentions that Hollywood seems to have a scheduling issue, and that WCW officials have decided that since Hogan hasn't defended his title since February, the Hulkster has to face Lex tonight. That's like
it's a long time.
4 months, guys.
Yeah. And he's not, well, spoiler, but he's not on the next pay-per-view. That's why they're talking about Bash at the Beach, which is not the next pay-per-view.
Whoa.
So we go to commercial, but we come back to Mike Tenay interviewing Ric Flair and Roddy Piper earlier in the day. They arrive in a white limo, with Mike asking about their match tonight versus the Outsiders. And Roddy says, we don't have to wait for no pay-per-view. They may call us dinosaurs, but we're a couple of hip dinosaurs.
I'm with it. I'm hip.
The Nature Boy chimes in that the Wolf Pack will think Bobby Orr and Larry Bird are walking that aisle tonight.
Wow.
Woo!
Names like that, you really are some dinosaurs.
I mean, I'd imagine that all 16,000 people there still know who those guys are.
Maybe not all.
Just the most.
In 97, those names aren't ancient.
It's like they all, like most of the people.
I'm trying to think if I knew who they were in 97. But
yeah. you weren't into sports.
No.
Also, you weren't from Massachusetts, where that like too. Your dad probably had like framed photos like of both of those men in
Bobby
his
Orr
house.
And Larry Bird are like
legends.
Legends, yeah. Yeah. Like,
I know he didn't have framed pictures of me in his house.
So we go to our second match. Alex Wright versus Chris Jericho. And we haven't seen Alex since World War III, 96, episode 229.
I was kind of happy to see him. It's been a while.
You know what he can do? He can dance.
He can dance.
If he wants to.
He can leave his friends behind?
I mean, he got left behind on every pay-per-view for a year, it seems.
S-S-S-S-A-A-A-F-F-F-E-E-E.
I shouldn't even start. I know how much Matt loves that song.
Immediately, Wright goes for a roll-up that gets a two count before yanking Chris down by his hair and controlling with headlocks and shoulder blocks. But Jericho responds with a clothesline and a springboard dropkick that sends Alex out to the floor. As Wright makes his way back to the apron, he drops Chris throat first across the ropes, followed by an elbow drop before returning to the ring to deliver several strikes and dance for the crowd. And they don't seem to like it very much.
No, I'm kind of digging, you know, Alex Wright as he's doing a pretty decent job being a, you know, heel.
Shithead heel.
Yeah, just shithead heel.
Jericho fires up with right hands, but Alex maintains control with a snap suplex and headed up top for a knee drop, only for Chris to move in time. But Jericho's unable to capitalize as Wright nails a spinning heel kick and chokes across the ropes, followed by a running back elbow, a scoop slam, and a slingshot body splash for a near fall. Alex then telegraphs a back body drop, allowing Chris to hit a sunset flip for a two count. But Wright is back on top with a sleeper hold to wear down his opponent, only for Jericho to elbow free and drive Alex down to the mat with a back suplex.
And, you know, Nitro might be beating the pants of Raw at the moment, but there's still an Austin 316 sign in the crowd.
Wright's back to his feet first, so he goes back to the sleeper, forcing Chris to escape once more, nailing a spin kick, but Alex delivers a clothesline for a near fall. And Wright keeps wearing down Jericho until sending him to a corner and charging in, where Chris gets a big boot up, allowing Jericho to hit a second rope dropkick. And Chris continues the attack with a thrust kick and a double underhook powerbomb for a two count, before clotheslining Alex and placing him in a tree of woe.
Whoa.
And Jericho baseball slides into Wright's face and starts to taunt him, allowing Alex to catch him in the midsection with a right hand, whipping him to a corner where Alex leaps up to the middle rope and backwards with a crossbody, only for Wright to roll through, making the cover with leverage for the pin.
And the win. This was nice and good.
Mm-hmm.
I did not expect Alex to win, so that's cool too.
We get a WCW Saturday Night commercial. Chris Benoit, Glacier, Public Enemy, Dean Malenko, and Diamond Dallas Page will all be on hand. 6:05 Eastern, Saturday night.
I love that they're still doing like the weird, like, you know, kind of like Terminator. Sci-fi thing.
Always.
I think they keep that through the entire
whole, really?
Yeah.
The entire run of that show.
Yeah, that was a staple of that show.
So funny, because it's like, oh, okay. But I guess it's the B show.
It's
how much more money are they going to put into it?
I mean, make it RoboCop. Don't be Terminator. You already have your affiliation.
Yeah, good point. Capital Combat.
So we go to our third match. Malia Hosaka versus Akira Hokuto with Sonny Ono for the WCW Women's World Championship. And Akira sticks her hand out for a handshake, which Hosaka finally goes for, only for Akuto to land a cheap shot and take control with a clothesline in a corner, followed by multiple hair tosses. And Akira keeps up the attack with a snap suplex and chokes on the ropes, but Malia fires back with a back kick, a pair of jumping forearms, before headed up top to fly off with a crossbody for a two count.
You don't get enough hair tosses in men's matches.
It's so disrespectful. I don't think they can fly as well either. I mean, these women are not the heaviest of people. I do love to see Akira Hokuto back in her sick ring gear with the the like lion mane and the like cyberpunk mask.
Yeah, her like, well, I guess no. I was going to say her Marilyn Manson inspired gear, but like, I don't, think that's on other shows.
Yeah, this is very, kind of feels like early Vader.
I can see that.
Odo jumps up on the apron, which draws the attention of Hosaka, allowing Hokuto to kick her from behind, followed by a brainbuster for the pin. And the win. Post-match, Akira delivers another brainbuster.
They're so nasty.
When Medusa comes running down to the ring, hitting three German suplexes on Hokuto, before trying to get a piece of Sunny, but the champ makes their way to the back. Still a thing, guys.
Gonna kick some bitches' ass.
Let the ladies get paid. I mean, I'd much rather see this than a like Duggan match.
True.
Could be. Yeah. This is. Yeah. I've got no complaints about this being here.
We go to commercial, but when we come back, Mean Gene is on the stage, and he introduces the Steiner brothers, with Rick saying that he doesn't know why they have to keep going through the same stuff. Because they had the NWO beaten. And Scott chimes in that they will go through all the tag teams here in WCW. Which happens to bring out Harlem Heat. To say that they won a title shot versus the Outsiders. Leading to the two teams brawling all around the stage area. Until officials come out to break it up.
Scott looks bigger than ever.
Yes, he's
He gains very like, pumped. Yeah, he gains like an inch of muscle.
I was going to
like,
say like
a
neck.
Yeah, neck every time we see him.
We go to our fourth match. Conan versus Steve Mongo McMichael with Deborah McMichael.
And the suitcase.
And as Mongo makes his way to the ring, Kevin Green attacks from out of nowhere, sending McMichael into a guardrail. Mongo responds with a not-so-rubber band slam on the railing and returns to walking down the aisle, only for Green to attack again.
Did you turn your back on him, buddy?
Back-to-back brawl pull-aparts.
Officials are out trying to separate them, but they don't do a very good job of it.
Not at all.
Because Kevin just keeps getting through them. The cameras then turn to the ring, and we see Conan is laid out in the ring with a broken broom next to him.
Who did it?
The ref has no clue what's going on, so he declares it a no contest. Shucks, guys, we don't get a Conan versus Mongo McMichael match.
Damn it. Yeah, I had to rewind back just to see, like, did I miss something? Did somebody attack him and I didn't notice?
Everybody watching missed something.
Apparently somebody did attack him and I didn't notice, but I did not see anyone.
They don't even say who attacked him, do they?
They don't say who attacked him. But maybe we'll find out next week.
Bum, bum, bum.
Who could it be?
We go to commercial, but we come back to Eric Bischoff and Hollywood Hogan making their way to the ring.
Woo!
Eric tells J.J. Dillon to bite him, that no one will be forcing the Hulkster to wrestle tonight. Hogan chimes in that Luger needs to start working out to wrestle him.
Sure.
That Lex could never beat him.
And
Hollywood decides that he will pose for the fans when Luger makes his way down to the ring. Hogan eventually turns around and he's face to face with Lex, telling him that Luger could never beat him. And Bischoff says that Lex and Sting are Hollywood wannabes. So Luger shoves Eric, and this leads us to our fifth match. Hollywood Hogan with Eric Bischoff versus Lex Luger. And Hulk goes to attack, but Lex blocks and delivers a running forearm that sends Hogan down to the floor. and the NWO all run down to ringside for support or possible cheating at some point.
Yeah.
We'll find out.
No.
As Hollywood makes his way back into the ring and asks for a test of strength.
Let's see if that makes sense here.
Yep. Big boys.
Only to nail a cheap shot, leading to a clothesline and multiple elbow drops. Our competitors exchange turnbuckle smashes, followed by another Luger running forearm as we go to commercial. But we come back to Hulk raking the back and delivering a clothesline in a corner before nailing a back suplex for a two count. Hogan hits a slam, but he then misses an elbow drop, allowing Lex to hit a body slam when the NWO would climb into the ring. So Luger just takes them all out with clotheslines. Lex turns in time to see Hollywood charging in, and he ducks the clothesline, lifting Hogan up into the torture rack for the submission and the win.
Whoa.
Can you believe it?
Unfortunately, it was a non-title match.
Yeah, but I mean, still pretty surprising. But it's like, well, if Hogan can't completely get out of it, this is as good as he's gonna get. Like, yeah, it's like, well, I gotta play ball sometimes.
Post-match, the NWO is back into attack, this time getting the best of Luger, beating him down and allowing Hulk to deliver between 8 and 12 leg drops.
Yeah, he's just spamming them.
Right as the second hour of Nitro begins, so we get pyro.
Oh, the fireworks.
Officials finally are able to pull Lex out of the ring. Actually, Mark Curtis like literally just like pulls him out and ends up falling to the floor like on his ass, which was kind of funny. Leaving the NWO to celebrate, including Bischoff and Hogan laying on the mat laughing about Luger wanting to challenge them.
It's very bizarre.
At Bash at the Beach.
Bizarre and uncomfortable. It's like, stand up. What are you guys doing? You don't look cool. You look like kids at a sleepover or something.
Yeah.
They don't understand what cool is, though.
This is, yeah, this is WCW cool.
Yeah, it's, it, yeah, they just don't, they just, yeah, they don't know cool.
But we go to commercial and but come back to Mean Gene with J.J. Dillon, who's the chairman of the WCW Executive Committee. They're in the ring, and JJ hopes that last week's attack is the last time that happens. Savage had attacked him the week before.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he believes his recommendation of a $50,000 fine is appropriate. Dillon says he knows Macho Man is desperate before announcing a few stipulations for Savage's match at the pay-per-view. It will be an unsanctioned, false count anywhere, and there will be a winner. So, basically just a no DQ match. Mm-hmm. False count anywhere, because I guess that's technically... Yeah. Macho then shows up in the crowd with a mic, saying he has $100,000 to cover last week's fine, and for this week as well. When DDP would run down to the ring, and he's ready to fight, leaping off the apron and brawling with Savage until security can break them apart. So how many times have we had officials break up fights now?
This is the fourth time?
Something like that.
It's, I guess, the fourth one, because the other one was the end of the Lex match. So, yeah, it's the fourth one.
In the matter of, like, three matches.
And also...
We gotta get better security, guys.
Yeah. Also, Hogan, after that match, when they're just, like, laying on the mat, he's like... He's calling Rod the Bod. It's like he apologizes to Rodman for losing, but he's like, but I'll make it up to you, and he like kisses the microphone. It's like, what are you doing? This is so bizarre.
Dennis Rod the Bod, man.
Yeah, it seems like they want to kiss in real life.
I mean, you got to remember Dennis Rodman back in this time, though.
Oh, I do.
He was wearing dresses and...
Yeah, but he was cool.
We go to commercial again, but come back to Lee Marshall on the road.
Talk about cool.
Calling in from Chicago to remind everybody to get their tickets for next week's Nitro. He's not even talking about the pay-per-view. He's talking about next week's Nitro.
Yeah. Lee Marshall makes fucking Todd Pettengill
look like a star.
Yeah, absolutely.
We go to our sixth match. Jeff Jarrett versus Dean Malenko for the WCW United States Championship.
Ooh.
We get back and forth action to start when Dean would roll up Double J several times, all for two counts, before also blocking a sunset flip with another roll up for a near fall, sending Jarrett out to the floor to regroup. At this time, Deborah McMichael makes her way down to the ring as Malenko body slams Double J. But Jarrett responds with stomps as we head to commercial. And we come back to Dean stomping away on Jarrett in a corner, only to have his whip reversed, allowing Double J to lock on a sleeper, which Malenko escapes by ramming Jarrett into a corner and applying a sleeper of his own. But Double J escapes with a back suplex. Now Deborah climbs on the apron, but no attention's paid to her as Dean telegraphs a back body drop, allowing Jarrett to deliver a DDT for a two count. Double J then telegraphs a back body drop of his own, so Malenko kicks him away before nailing a clothesline and a vertical suplex for a near fall.
That DDT was like, it just looked like a really tight snap suplex, and you can see it on Dean Malenko's face where he's like, well, that didn't go correctly. It's like, for a guy who's got ice water in his veins, you could just see it on his face. He's like, well, we didn't fuck that up too bad, but that's not what it was supposed to be.
Yep, I'm thinking, you know, Dean was probably thinking at the time, if I was the one that was doing it, it would have been right. Number 873 of
he
my
is,
whole
moves. Yeah,
there's
no guy that I'm like more happy to see on any of these shows than Dean Malenko with a worthy opponent.
Jarrett's thrown to the floor with Dean following up to continue the punishment before returning to the ring with a half crab, a bow and arrow, and a leg lock. Malenko releases the hold to nail a leaping knee for a two count, but Double J reverses a whip and catches Dean for a tombstone piledriver, followed by locking on a figure four. But Dean succeeds in turning it over, causing Jarrett to grab the ropes to break it up, leaving both men feeling the pain in their legs.
Could use some, you know, painkillers.
Malenko catches a kick and spins Double J around, only to be taken down by a clothesline. But Dean responds with a double underhook powerbomb and goes for the Texas Cloverleaf, when Jarrett would just cradle up Malenko for a near fall. Dean tries a backslide pin attempt for two, followed by Double J hitting a swinging neckbreaker for a near fall. Jarrett then sends Malenko to a corner, only for him to leap over the ropes, causing Double J to charge right into the turnbuckle, while Dean climbs to the top, coming off with a double axe handle. But Jarrett blocks and sets Malenko back on the top rope for a superplex.
Yeah.
We then see Eddie Guerrero, with arms still in sling,
hey there, buddy,
climb over the guardrail and head up top to nail a frog splash on Dean.
Uh-oh.
He rips the sling off and throws it in Malenko's face, all while Deborah is on the apron, distracting the ref. Double J then applies the figure four for the submission and the win. And new!
I mean, what a fucking great match. It's perfect television wrestling. This is better than most matches you see on pay-per-view, even. There's a point where, like, we know Bobby Heenan. He's the color guy. He, like, points out that this is a great match, but he says it extremely earnestly, and it's just like, yeah, because when was the last time he saw one? Like, it's not super common that the kind of match Bobby Heenan would think is good happens on the shows that they are covering. Yeah, Dean Malenko, my God. What a guy.
Mean Gene's on the stage area with the Jimmy Hart and the Faces of Fear. And Jimmy says he has a surprise for Chris Benoit, introducing his third and final step, Kevin Sullivan. Taskmaster says that he is home again and thanks the people that are home with him, before calling out the Crippler for a fight, followed by telling the Faces of Fear not to touch him. And the Crippler comes out and the two begin to brawl.
Again! Also, there's not a guy that I want to love more than Kevin Sullivan. And it's, he makes it really difficult because, like, this promo is ass. He just can't get the words out. He's a guy that I've just wanted to love, and I've never really gotten anything out of. And it bums me out.
Yeah.
Because I just want it. I want to love Kevin Sullivan. I'm sure he's a good guy. I think he's got a reputation for being a pretty all right guy as far as wrestling dudes go.
Yeah, I just...
And he's been a booker. He probably has a pretty decent mind for the business, but it's hard to tell because what's cool about the Dungeon of Doom?
Nothing.
And Ming. It hasn't been. Yeah, Ming. But if it's like, true. Fuck, yeah. I mean, but Ming's the coolest guy in any room.
Yeah. Jacqueline would jump on Benoit's back, followed by Ming locking on the Tongan death grip.
Yeah.
And the dungeon continues to beat down the Crippler as we go to commercial. So I assume that Kevin Sullivan and Benoit face off against each other on the next pay-per-view.
Again.
Makes sense, right?
Why start a new feud when you can just reignite an old one?
I mean, yeah, that seems like the logic most of the time in wrestling. So.
We then go to our seventh match. The Outsiders of Scott Hall and Kevin Nash with six versus the Nature Boy, Ric Flair, and Roddy Piper. And all four men start brawling, leaving both Nate and Roddy down as we head to commercial. But we come back to Nash working over Piper with knee lifts, elbows in a corner, before also choking him with his boot. Roddy crawls his way to the corner, so Kevin knocks Flair off the apron to stop the tag, and allowing the Outsiders to continue the punishment on Piper, as Hall enters to deliver right hands. Now Roddy fights out of his opponent's corner momentarily, but the double team is too much, bringing Nash back in for a powerbomb, only for Piper to low blow him, sending Kevin falling back to his corner to make a tag.
Does anybody, like, just brawl from, like, underneath better than Roddy Piper? Where he's just like, it's like, yeah, I'm getting my ass kicked, but I'm gonna, he sells so well, holding himself up on the ropes and still giving into it.
Throwing the occasional thumb to the eye.
Yeah, he's truly, he is a one of a kind. Nobody else works like him, nor could they. He's just, yeah, he's the best.
Roddy again attempts to make the crawl to the corner, but Scott applies a sleeper to slow him down. So Piper mule kicks Hall to escape, only for Six to yank the Nature Boy off the apron as Roddy leaps for the tag.
No hot tag.
Yep, and then, yeah, this is trash. We're getting trash in the... I mean, it is Massachusetts. You're in Boston.
Nathan just starts chopping away on the floor, sending the kid running away into the ring, where Piper gets in a shot as well. And everyone just starts brawling away again, so the ref calls for the bell and the double DQ.
And I don't know if... Oh, what's his name from ECW? The Whistle Man.
Bill Alfonso.
Alfonso. I don't know if he was in the building and had a hold of that fucking bell, but oh my god.
And he rang the hell out of it.
Ugh.
Post-match, Flair and Roddy get beaten down by the Wolfpack until Piper nails Nash with a title belt. The Horsemen then come running down to the ring to brawl, which brings out more NWO members to brawl. Kevin Green then comes down to go after Mongo, but Nash intervenes momentarily, so Green has to fight Kevin and Scott Norton off so he can brawl with McMichael in the aisleway. Harlem Heat starts making their way to the ring when the Steiners would attack them from behind, leading to them brawling in the aisleway and to the announce table area. Glacier, Wrath, and Mortis are now brawling in the stage area.
So everybody in the locker room.
Yep.
Followed by all of the cruiserweights from our opening match have now come out to do so as well. And the crowd starts chanting for Sting.
We want Sting because he's kind of the only guy that's missing here.
Oh, we're still missing at least three more.
Yep.
Because the Dungeon comes running down to fight Benoit. Macho Man Randy Savage then comes running down to the ring.
Can I get another?
To beat down Flair. So, of course, Diamond Dallas Page comes out as well. And he stomps away, fighting off the rest of the NWO. he pancakes Macho when Hogan would come out of nowhere to nail both Paige and the Nature Boy with a title belt.
Is it, has Alex Wright or Chris Jericho come out? I think they're the only people that are missing.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're like, we are already at the hotel bar.
They're, you know, in catering, dancing or something.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, Sting descends from the rafters with baseball bat in hand.
It's fucking cool. He's so quick.
Standing over DDP to protect him. The Stinger would whack Nash, Norton, and Buff Bagwell to keep them away before hooking Paige up to his harness. Sting and DDP are then lifted back to the rafters as Shivani yells, "Good night, everybody!" And we fade to black.
And they went up fast.
Yeah. What's crazy is that this brawl went on for like way too like 4 minutes too long. And if they just let Conan have a goddamn match, or at least half a match, then this would have been the correct amount of time. But the Sting reveal, like, coming down is still so cool and hot that it doesn't matter, and he's down there to save the other biggest baby face in the company at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So it ends on a high note, obviously.
So I ask you, gentlemen, what are your overall thoughts of WCW Monday Night Nitro from June 9th, 1997?
I enjoyed it. I don't know, it was fun. It was an easy watch. I kept waiting for, what's the reason that we're watching this? Is there a championship that changes hand?
Yep.
But I think we watched it because it was an entertaining show.
I mean, Hogan taking a loss is a reason. Sting, of course, is a reason. And then...
Jarrett beat Malenko.
Yeah. Jarrett beat Malenko is a reason.
We did have a title. Yeah.
But it's a fun show. NWO looks whack on this show. DDP and Lex look fucking great. Dean Malenko and Jeff Jarrett was awesome in the kind of wrestling that I like to see on a regular basis. But, yeah, and I love, you know, the Sting love. I'm here for it, but that brawl, not to beat a dead horse, went on for so long, and, like, hindsight, it's like, maybe I would have carried it at the time. Because I remember watching, like, Raw go off the air with just, like, crazy brawls and being, like, so hyped. And then being like, fuck, I guess I have to go to bed now. But watching it now, it's like, you're older, care about less things. And, we're reviewing the shows. So I've got a keener eye. And we've watched a lot of them, guys.
So I originally, after finishing, I wrote, there was a pace about the show that just kept it entertaining.
Absolutely.
That's really all I wrote.
I would say that it's a funner watch than it was to talk through.
Yeah, because as we were going through it, I realized...
Which isn't always the case.
Because, like, literally, as I pointed out, after, like, the fourth brawl and officials breaking it up in, like, three segments, I was just like, oh, this show just really is everyone just brawling. And I was just like, this show's not that good. Now that I'm, like... thinking about it, but I'm just like,
this was,
but it was super entertaining to watch.
WCW does ECW,
kind of, yeah,
with it's
their flavor of it.
This guy's gonna have a brawl, or these guys are gonna have a brawl, 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 and then at the end everybody's gonna have a brawl, but we're gonna bring them back in the little stages that we brought them out originally in, and everybody kind of intertwine, because, you know, it's like
it was an Tommy Dreamer and Luna
show up four times throughout a show.
Yeah, but I mean, it is one of those things where it's like, oh, this is really fun, and I even tracked while I was watching it. It's like just brawls again, and brawls and break-aparts, brawls and break-aparts, but there's some extreme high points on this show. Hogan having to submit, pretty fucking sick. I'm stoked for that. I know that it's probably
I don't know if you remember this. Luger technically still has a title shot that he hasn't gotten yet.
Yeah. And, and then Jarrett and Malenko. Malenko might just be my favorite guy at the moment.
It's an easy guy to like.
I mean, I love, as I was watching that match, it's like, he's kind of, like, at this point in this podcast, he's my favorite guy currently working. And I love Stone Cold Steve Austin, but what Malenko does is more to my taste as far as, like, in-ring Yeah. You know, wrestling.
He's that silent assassin instead of the guy that gets in your face and talks shit before he kicks you in the
gut. He's so cool, and he's a lone, complete lone wolf. Like, he's not, there's no allegiance. He's just out there by himself.
Mm-hmm. Good. Where's the smart marks at? There. All right, fuck you.
I think it's time we smark it up. So what are some of the best moments of this show? One of Luger beating Hogan.
Yes.
Is a awesome. Huge moment.
Not only because Luger beat Hogan, but we also get different music at the end of the show because Luger beat Hogan in the main event.
Right? No.
No, that was the middle of the show.
Main event, nobody won. It's just
That was the Outsiders. Yeah, that's right. Why am I thinking that Luger and Hogan ended
because
the show?
It was the main event.
But it was a disqualification on 6.
Yeah.
So we won't be playing NWO music.
Woo! Or,
woo! I mean,
pretty close.
Yeah. Piper, just like, we all love Rick. He's one of the best to ever do it. But Piper is the star. He's coming out after Ric Flair. He's getting more time in the ring. The crowd is hotter for him. People love to woo, but they are living and breathing on what Piper's doing in the ring.
I enjoyed the opening match. The 6 of them were fun, and I don't know. It's always good for me to watch a match full of guys in masks and know who each of them are, because we watch so much New Japan, and I don't really know who a lot of people are still yet. So, I mean, granted, I grew up watching all of these guys with the exception of Silver King, because I didn't know who that name was.
On WCW. Anyway.
Honestly, the worst match is the main event.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, Piper did a great job.
Still entertaining, but like none of those guys are doing wrestling moves. Like,
I mean, Piper never really does anyway.
No.
Eddie's frog splash was on point as always.
Yeah, the Eddie coming out and fucking hit stuff up and then throwing the sling down was good high energy.
Medusa with her textbook German suplexes, complete with back arch.
Yeah. Some of the hair whips are always nasty, but there's some pretty nasty ones here.
I mean, Sting's...
I was going to say, we have to mention Sting here, because
It's very often you see Sting come down from the rafters, but it's not as often that you see him grab somebody else and lift them up.
Yeah, like he hasn't come down from the rafters that many times.
Super fast motion like that.
He's probably come down more than we've seen him, because he probably does it more on TV than he does.
I guess so.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it became a weekly. That was the Sting spot.
Yeah.
You stopped looking in the bleachers and you kept looking up, waiting to see where he was going to drop from.
You think we'll get, what's the guy's name? Is it Bill Skarsgård? They're remaking The Crow. Do you think he'll do some stuff on AEW? That would be a bummer.
He's going to be The Crow?
Sting actually...
it's
Sting
one of the Scars. It's not Alex.
The Raptors,
it's Bill, I
on
think.
Dynamite
yeah.
on
the
Wednesday.
It guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I saw a Twitter thing of him coming down.
Wait, what?
Sting actually came down from the rafters on Dynamite on Wednesday.
Like, the cables are hooked to his boots.
And they,
like, it's because he's fucking pushing 70. Yeah. So, we got to do a little bit more.
And they, Tony reached out to Hart. What's her name? Maria? Mm-hmm. Not Maria.
Oh, Owens.
Yeah.
I think.
Is that right? Owens' wife.
Yeah.
Basically, hey, we're going to do... Are you okay with us doing this?
Yeah.
Because, you know, they have the whole Owen Hart
thing.
Which I thought was like...
Respectful.
Yeah, super
sure.
respectful of that.
It's like you don't want to offend somebody that, I mean, like you...
Especially considering they do the Owen Hart little tournament thing. So don't piss off the misses.
How about most disappointing? There was just brawl after brawl after brawl.
Yeah, and I don't have an issue with the brawls. My biggest issue is that the last brawl was too long. That's all. But they have everybody that's in a feud going into the pay-per-view square off, so it makes sense to get you hyped for it. It's just that it didn't work for me, and it went on too long.
I gotta throw this back in the best part, just because with all the brawling that was going on, whoever's idea it was that we need Glacier and Mortis to join in the fray, it made me laugh when I saw them all of a sudden brawling too. Like, okay,
that just means we're gonna get a Glacier Mortis match coming up, I bet, because they don't ever fight anyone else. It is funny. I love the idea that they are just a satellite surrounding the planet that is WCW at the moment. It's kind of fun.
I mean, that's the thing, is like, I'm saying that the brawling thing is a disappointing, but like, it wasn't disappointing while I was watching it.
No.
It was only disappointing while we were going through it, and I'm realizing that
it's like, oh like, yeah, these are
kind of the same.
This was a lot of the same, but I'm not mad about it by any means. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like literally like, was there anything else I was disappointed on this show? And I'm just like,
I mean, the majority of the in-ring stuff is great. I was disappointed in Kevin Sullivan's promo, but when are you not?
Yeah.
It's not one of those things that's surprising. It's just kind of a bummer.
Hogan and Bischoff laying in the ring after that match.
Yeah, then just when those guys try to be cool, it's cringy.
It's not disappointing or whatever. It's just like, it's more of a why.
Yeah. Rod the Bod, I'll make it up to you.
How about best performer of the night?
Dean Malenko.
I was going to say the 18,003 people that were in the...
Oh, they were hot.
They were fucking hot. They were
throwing trash. I mean, they're probably all drunk. 90% of their lives are in Boston.
I don't know if he got really hit, but Conan played the part of, I just got knocked out in the middle of the ring with everybody watching, but nobody's seeing.
I wouldn't be surprised if he actually did get hit with the broom. It's still just a broom.
Like, they could have gimmicked it, too.
Yeah.
But he lay there like he had just legit been murdered. Yeah. So, but no, not him. Yeah, either that or DDP. Start of the show, end of the show, kick through some limo windows.
Lex was feeling himself.
Yeah, that's true. Lex was great.
What's funny is like that when Lex shows up earlier in the show, and I'm like, oh, he looks great. He's got great energy about him, but it's he knows that he gets to fucking get one over on Hogan finally. And it's that, yeah, it's not necessarily the victory that we'd all love to see, but it's a lot for him, a guy who's been so hot and cold and back and forth between companies over these years. And it's like, let Lex have a goddamn moment. And I think he looked great doing it.
Absolutely. How about most surprising of the episode?
I mean, Hogan losing.
Welcome back, Eddie.
Yeah, I think you're right on the Hogan losing.
Hogan losing is the big... Oh, it's got to be.
Because when's the last time Hogan lost?
Yeah, and he lost to a submission, which is even crazier.
Well, that's true.
That's true, but this is on TV, and it's a submission.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, his last two, he's been...
And it was
submitted and put to sleep.
And Lex didn't do any cheating or anything like that. He totally made the NWO... look like fucking punks, and then tapped out their fucking boss. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a torture rack, and Lex Luger is huge, and Hulk Hogan is huge, and him torture racking another guy that big is just a wonderful visual.
And now for a look back even further into the history of wrestling.
The dusty finish.
Sting had become the WCW International World Heavyweight Champion 3 weeks earlier, when he would head to Fukuoka, Japan, for Wrestling Dontaku on May 1st, 1994, to face the man he had been feuding with over the past few months in a ravishing Rick Rude. The match would start off back and forth until the Stinger would hit several elbow drops to take control, forcing the Ravishing One to the floor, when Sting would fly out with a slingshot plancha. Stinger would continue the punishment with a vertical suplex on the ramp before delivering a flying clothesline from a top turnbuckle. Rude finally changes the momentum after avoiding a Stinger splash on a guardrail, sending Sting crashing into the steel. And the Ravishing One takes the fight back inside the ring, nailing a flying clothesline of his own, followed by attempting a flying knee drop, only for Stinger to meet him on the turnbuckles for a superplex. Rude then gets his knees up on a running splash and begins to work the ribs with a bear hug and more strikes, until Sting rallies to kick the Ravishing One in the head. But Rude reverses a suplex to drop the Stinger across the ropes before hitting another suplex on the stage area. They make their way back into the ring, where they trade strikes, sleepers, and military presses that sends the Ravishing One back out to the floor, where he grabs the belt and attempts to smack Sting with it, only for the ref to grab it away, allowing the Stinger to dropkick Rude from behind, followed by a clothesline descending out to the floor. Sting would climb the turnbuckles to fly out, but the Ravishing One would pull his valet in front of him. So the Stinger jumps down and removes her, allowing Rude to clock Sting with the title. The Ravishing One would quickly throw the Stinger into the ring, but only a near fall. So he keeps up the attack by nailing a pile driver and a top rope knee drop for the pin to become champion for the third time. Unfortunately, this would be the last match of Rude's career, as he broke his back on the plancha early in the match and would be forced to vacate the title, leaving the title up for grabs very soon.
And we've talked about it a lot, but it's one of the biggest, like, what-ifs of modern wrestling. It's like, Rude has been just... Yeah, he was probably better than he'd ever been at this point in his career as far as, like, in-ring and stuff. And
can you imagine how awesome it would be for Sting's final match to have Rude be one of the great opponents of his past sitting ringside?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But, yeah. Rick Rude, potentially could have been a long-standing top heel in WCW.
He was about to run the world.
Maybe we never had to deal with an NWO. It's not like it saved WCW anyway.
I mean, he definitely would have had a different role in the NWO.
Yeah, for sure.
Next week, Great American Bash 1997.
Oh, Gad, we're going for the gab.
Music from this week's show is Firestorm, and Flair came out last, so... Sure, why not? We'll play his music. Spotch Zarathustra by Strauss.
You could mix it up with the Piper song. That would probably sound horrific.
Probably.
Have like the drums starting off. Okay. And then it runs into the boom, boom, boom. And then it has the bagpipes coming. Yeah. It could be a banger.
All right. Download Fruity Loops.
If you like this episode or any of our other ones, please go out there and rate and review us on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts at. Do as Michael says.
5 stars or no stars.
And if you have any questions, comments, concerns.
Oh, if you got any recipes, drink ideas, we're going to Illinois. We're going to be illin' it, huh? Yeah, if you've ever been to Illinois, Chicago, or anywhere in Illinois, slide into our DMs, shoot us a message, something like that. Tell me what we should try. What'd you eat? What'd you drink? What's your best friend that lives in Chicago, or I can't think of any other town in Illinois off the top of my head at the moment other than Moline.
Lanford.
There we go, Lanford.
Springfield.
Oh yeah, Springfield. That is another one. Yeah, I forgot.
Just Springfield in every damn state.
But yeah, if you got an idea for us, what should we eat, drink for the Great American Bash? Let us know. Hit us up on the old X.
Hot dogs and beer. It's the Great American Bash, game.
You can email any of that stuff at WrestlingHistoryX@gmail.com or find us on X at WrestlingHistoX. It's Wrestling HISTO.
Rex.
We'll talk to you next week.
Laters.